Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Mary Cranston, senior partner of Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman and the board chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. I'd also like to welcome our radio audience and remind everyone that you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my very great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Dee Dee Myers, former White House Press Secretary, political analyst, and author of Why Women Should Run the World. Let me tell you a little bit more about Dee Dee Myers. When President Clinton was elected, Dee Dee was told that she would be the acting press secretary and that the job was just for the transition. Only 31 at the time, Dee Dee was excited to be part of the administration and wasn't that conscious that she was being shortchanged with that kind of an offer. Fortunately for the Clinton years, she was appointed the official press secretary in January of 1993, and as is widely acknowledged, did an excellent job in her 2 years in the post. She was the youngest person ever in that job and the first woman in the role. That's a lot of pressure to take on your shoulders, but she did it and did it well. As she writes in her book, I wasn't the first woman to be the first woman, of course. I stand on the shoulders of the countless others who stuck their necks out and sometimes had their heads knocked off for going where no woman had gone before. Because of them, those of us who followed have had more different and better opportunities. Dee Dee's book is resonating deeply with the women who are in business and politics today. It's already on the New York Times bestseller list. She's not afraid to speak plainly of the reality of cultural bias against women. Told through the prism of her own life, this book explores the stories of women who've had the courage and valor to, throughout history, to open up opportunities that were closed to women before. And she pulls together anecdotes and extensive modern research to create a fresh take on the barriers that women are up against and the new and better world that we'll have once those barriers are gone. Dee Dee currently lives in Washington, D.C. with her husband, Todd Purdom, the national editor of Vanity Fair and the former L.A. bureau chief of the New York Times. She has 2 children, Catherine and Stephen, and she is currently a political commentator for MSNBC. So without further ado, let me ask Dee Dee to make her comments and welcome her to our meeting.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mary. When I talk about the women on whose shoulders I stand, I'm talking about Mary Cranston, who's a pathbreaker and a role model and an inspiration in her own right. So thank you for that. It's great to be here in San Francisco. I'm from California. I'm from Los Angeles. I went to school at Santa Clara down the road, where I got to go to the Silicon Valley Commonwealth Club. It's so great to see so many old friends in this audience today. It's really a treat. So thanks for having me. And you really can ask hard questions. That's okay. There's nothing I haven't been asked. I always feel like a priest when I say that, you know, like there's no sin I haven't heard. So go ahead and tell it like it is. Anyway, when I was getting ready to come and see speak with you all, I was reminded of a story that I heard recently about one of my favorite Washington characters, Rush Limbaugh. And it seems Rush was in Washington not too long ago, and he was out jogging, because he's a big athlete, and he was going along the Potomac River. And he came on these 3 girls who were riding their bikes, and they recognized him, and they waved, and he was flattered that these young girls recognized him. So he waved back, and somehow he became very distracted by all this, and he fell into the river. Not to worry, though. The girls saw him, and they rushed over, and they pulled him out, and they revived him. And he was so grateful. He said, "Girls, thank you for saving me. I'd like to do something special for each of you." And the first girl said, "Well, I could use a new bike." And he said, "Done." And the second girl thought about it. She said, "Well, when I get bigger, can I go on your radio show?" And he said, "Absolutely, as long as you're not a liberal." And the third girl thought about it. She said, "Mr. Limbaugh," she said, "this is a tall order, but you're a powerful man. I would like to be buried at Arlington National Cemetery." And he looked at her and he said, "My goodness, you can't be more than 10 years old. How on earth could you possibly be thinking about where you want to be buried?" She said, "Well, when I get home and tell my mom who I just saved..." Now, the truth is that story has nothing to do with anything. I just like making fun of Rush Limbaugh. Who doesn't? Anyway, I am delighted, as I said, to be here to talk about, among other things, about my book, Why Women Should Rule the World, and about the current state of our politics when we get to the questions and answers. I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that might come up. The title is a bit provocative. It's a little bit meant to be a little tongue-in-cheek, but I actually believe it. But here's how I came to write a book called Why Women Should Rule the World. It was after the 2004 presidential campaign. And I was despondent. And it wasn't just because George Bush was reelected, although for me that probably would have been enough. But I thought the state of our politics was pretty depressing. It was all about red states and blue states and how we had nothing in common and, how bitter politics had become. And it was all about winning the argument and not about solving problems. So I said, I'm going to write a book about compromise, about how we have more in common than we realize and how we should work together to solve our problems. And I wrote a book proposal and I submitted it and I got a publisher and it was all going along. Although I can't say there was a lot of enthusiasm for the topic of, because who would want... You know, the American people aren't interested in talking about coming together to solve our problems and about playing to our hopes and not our fears and can't we all, work together. That would never sell. But I started to think about, as I started to kind of get ready to do this book, I started to ask myself, what would it really take to change things? What would really make a difference? How could we really get to a more collegial kind of politics? And I looked around and I asked, is there anybody doing what I'm talking about? Is anybody practicing what I'm preaching? And as I looked around, I found there were certain people who were practicing what I was preaching. And one of the places was among the women in the United States Senate. You know, these women on paper are very different. They have nothing in common. They come from big states and small states and both coasts and the middle, and they're liberal and conservative, and they're interested in transportation and energy and national security and children's issues, those women's issues. But they looked for reasons to work together. They looked for bills that they could sponsor together. Not only did they work together, they're friends. They have dinner together once a month. You know, one of Senator Feinstein's best friends is Kay Bailey Hutchinson, who she has almost nothing in common with in terms of ideology and politics, but they spend a lot of time together because they have other interests. And I thought, okay, that's it. That's it. Our problems, things will be better if there are more women. Women should rule the world. That's it. So I called my editor and I said, I'm going to write a book called Why Women Should Rule the World. And she said, okay. So here I am, 2 years later. So that's how it all started. But then I was committed to writing a book called Why Women Should Rule the World, I started to ask myself, well, can I really, I believe this. I believe that more women would make, in positions of authority across public life, would make the world better. But can I prove it? If I go look at the evidence, will that lead me to the same conclusion? And so, there's some places there haven't been a lot of women really running societies. But I said, I'm going to just take this journey and see where it leads me. So I started to read, books and articles and magazine pieces and studies, and I interviewed lots and lots of women, which was great. I went around the country and talked to all kinds of women from all different walks of life. And I got very interested in the science because I was interested in what makes men and women different. You'll be shocked to find out that after all my research, I find out that I had been right all along. That women should, in fact, rule the world, and not in place of men. But alongside men, because of my book, I love men. My father's a man, my husband's a man, I gave birth to a little tiny man, and I think men bring a lot of skills and talent to the table as well, but I think women bring sometimes different kinds of skills. We have a different life experience. We sometimes see the world differently. We sometimes have different approaches to solving problems. And I thought if you could bring all those things together, all those talents and qualities together, if we could stop, eliminating people from the talent pool because they wear a skirt, we're definitely going to get a better look at our problems and we're going to get better solutions. And again, this is not an argument about what's politically correct. We're not doing this, you know, it's not hold hands, sing kumbaya, and put more women in positions of power to make ourselves feel good. It's just it's an argument about self-interest, because when there are more women in positions of authority, business is more efficient and profitable. Governments are more democratic. They're more representative. Societies are freer. Around the world, societies with more women in positions of power tend to be more peaceful. I mean, women are instrumental to peace processes, to sustaining and maintaining and bringing about and forging peace. So again, it's about our self-interest. But I did, and again, one of the things that we have to acknowledge, I think, is that women are in many ways different. If women are expected to be just like men, you know, men are always going to be better at being men than we are. So as long as we try to be just like men, I think we will continue to be not as good. And so I think one of the imperatives here is to acknowledge the ways in which we're different. And that's why I got interested in the science, because I wanted to start at the biology. I mean, we all know we're different. And now that I have a boy and a girl at home, I really know that they're different. I didn't have any brothers. And then I had this little girl, and that was all familiar to me. And then I had this little boy, and it was like, oh, my God, why didn't somebody warn me? He's adorable. I love him, but he's different than my daughter for a lot of reasons, but gender is a big one. Anyway, so I started to look at the biology, and one of the things I learned was that male and female brains are exactly the same for about the first 8 weeks in utero. And then male brains get, baby brains get a big dose of testosterone, which starts killing off brain cells in the communication and emotion processing centers and feeding the growth of brain cells in the aggression and sex centers. Really. And I was kind of like, wow, and duh, all at the same time. So, you know, from the very earliest times, men and women are different, and our brains work slightly differently. Another interesting thing, I think, is that men's and women's brains are, men's brains are a little bit bigger, but we have the same, roughly the same amount of neurons. So we women just pack them more efficiently into a smaller space. And women have more places, more connective tissue between the two halves of their brain, and the two halves of women's brains are less specialized, which means that scientists don't know exactly what it means, but it seems like women use both sides of their brains to do things like process language. So a stroke that might leave a man unable to speak would be much less debilitating oftentimes than a woman, because women use both sides, so women can transfer some of their language functions to the other side of the brain. So men tend to be more focused. Women tend to be better multitaskers. There's no woman on earth that, you know, has a family that doesn't think she's a better multitasker than her husband. I haven't met her yet. If there's anyone out there, please see me after, who doesn't think she's a better multitasker than most of the men in her life. So those differences became very interesting to me. I also recognize that, you know, talking too much about biological differences can have a downside, because biology has been used to keep women down for a long time. You know, we're too emotional and too rational and, you know, can't parallel park, for God's sake, and God knows we can't do math. So, you know, all those things that we hear about women. But I do think, again, that unless you acknowledge that there are differences, every woman is going to be held to the male norm and the male standard. I think what we have to do instead is to give more value to the way women see the world, and to give more value to the experience that women bring. And to say that there are more than one way to lead, and there's more than one way to manage, and that a women's perspective is just as valuable as men's. There's a comprehensive review in Harvard Business Review recently about all the studies that look at whether men and women manage differently and whether they have different leadership styles. And the answer is, yeah, they're slightly different. You know, most leaders, you know, they're not all one or all the other. They sort of pick this quality from column A and this quality from column B. But women do bring a slightly different, in the aggregate, leadership and management styles. And I think the more we recognize that, and the more we make more styles available to both men and women, the better off we're going to be. And the more we, again, value women's skills. So then looking around the world at all the ways that I think women bring those skills and make the world better, I had to ask myself, if it's such a panacea of progress, if women could help solve all these problems, why haven't we been able to make more progress? I think we've made tremendous progress in some ways. But in other ways, you know, we're 16% of the United States Senate, 16% of the House, for example, very small numbers in terms of CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. Why is it? What are the obstacles that still hold women back? And there are a number. I think some of them are external and some of them are internal. The external obstacles, I think, are like things such as women, I think, are still held to a different standard than men. I think it's still harder for women's accomplishments to get as much, to be taken as seriously and to be given as much credit as the same things that men accomplish. that is, we see that over and over again in these studies that show, for example, women used to make up really small numbers of major orchestras in the United States and around the world. And about 20 years ago, musicians' unions started demanding that auditions for orchestras happen behind screens because they thought there was a lot of bias that came into selecting. You know, people hear with their eyes as well as their ears. Once musicians started auditioning behind screens, the number of women in major orchestras increased fivefold. Fivefold. Similarly, there have been a lot of studies that look at blind resumes, where they gave, for example, there was one that showed that they took a department in a university, and they gave the professors, both men and women, resumes of would you want to hire this person into your department? And so they put they took the exact same resume, put a man's name on it in one group and a woman's name on it in the other group, and the both men and women were substantially more likely to say the male name was more qualified and they were more likely to be hired than the female name, just on the basis of who they thought had made those accomplishments. I think I see it every day in this presidential campaign. Maybe not every day, every other day. I think Hillary Clinton has had to meet a different threshold to prove that she's qualified to be commander-in-chief. I think that a woman, I publicly haven't taken a position on this campaign, although I'll confess I found myself more compelled by the Clinton campaign than I ever thought I would. I see things that happened to her, and I'm beside myself some days, and I've taken it very personally. But I would be very happy with either candidate, and I think Barack Obama is totally qualified to be president. That said, I don't think a woman with his resume would have gotten out of the starting blocks. If a woman came and said, oh, I've been in the state legislature for 8 years and in the United States Senate for two, I want to be president, people would have gone, no, really, what do you want to do? And instead, Senator Obama has proved that somebody with those credentials can really be a successful candidate. But it had to be a he. And I think Senator Clinton, on the other hand, has a pretty substantial, a very substantial resume, in my opinion. But she spent the last year running a campaign based on experience and ready on day one. And I think when people have criticized that campaign and said, why did she base her campaign so much on experience? In some ways, because she had to. She had to prove, she had to underscore, she had to make sure people were comfortable with her as commander-in-chief. Now, I certainly don't argue that all of her problems are gender-related, not by a long shot, but I do think some of them are gender-related. Another example, if she had said, I will negotiate with the leaders of Iran, North Korea, and Cuba without preconditions, I think it would have been a firestorm. Senator Obama has said that. It's a reasonable position to take in a lot of people's view. He's gotten a little bit of flack for it, but not a lot. I think it would have been a big, huge scandal if Hillary Clinton had said it. It would have been, oh, you see why we can't have women? They're going to give away the store on the first day. Those are the serious and I think sometimes subtle external obstacles. I think there are the ones that are equally, not equally, they're also difficult. For example, we all know women are judged by their appearance. And that's we've seen that with Hillary Clinton. You know, it's her hair, it's her pantsuit. Do we like her pantsuit? What about her ankles? What about the day she showed up on the Senate floor with a smidgen of cleavage and people went crazy in Washington? I don't know if you guys paid as much attention to that here. It was as if she was doing the tango with Castro on the Capitol steps. I know in my life I've gotten it. Every time I go on the Today Show or some other TV show, I get emails from people, and almost always the first thing they say is, you looked great, or you looked good. And I'm always happy to hear that. But sometimes you get, oh, I liked your hair. But if you get, you changed your hair, that's really bad. Because that means they didn't like your hair, and they spent the whole segment thinking about what they didn't like about your hair, and they couldn't hear a word you said. So a bad hair day becomes a virtual mute button for a lot of women. And I think that's just a standard that men haven't had to face. Now, those are some of the external. And then, of course, one of the other obstacles, of course, is the mother of all obstacles is still motherhood. Managing large jobs with small children is still a big challenge. And I don't think we as a society are nearly as far along as we could be or need to be in finding ways to make it possible, more possible for women to do those two things for a lot of reasons. One, I read in the Wall Street Journal that it costs $2,500 to replace the Domino's pizza delivery guy. And we all know how skilled the Domino pizza delivery guy is. I can't imagine what it costs to replace an associate or a partner in a law firm. Hundreds of thousands of dollars that are invested in those more. So why don't we find ways to keep those women in their jobs, or find ways to keep them peripherally involved so if they want to take some time off, they can come back? There's no reason other than, I mean, sometimes, you know, some jobs in businesses are more complicated than others, I understand. But I think many of the obstacles are simply a lack of will. And it seems ridiculous to me because our society says the most important thing you can do is raise your children. And a lot of us agree with that. That is the so why don't we value the skills that come with raising a family? I think I would much rather hire me after having children than hire me before I had children. I would be much better at any endeavor. I'm more patient. I'm better at reading nonverbal cues from people. I'm better, God knows I'm more efficient. I use my time better. I'm better at prioritizing. I can figure out how to make two kids watch one show. People with four kids, if the mother has four kids and can figure out how to make four kids watch one show, I think you can make world peace. But those, you know, we don't really value those skills. I think those are, and men too, by the way. It's not just women who are parents. Men are parents too. I think we should value, and not all people are parents, but I think, you know, why isn't being, raising children really a credential that we value in our society? I think it should be. So those are some of the external obstacles. I think there are also internal obstacles. I think we women don't sometimes give ourselves enough credit. It's not just men or our bosses or whatever who don't value our accomplishments. Sometimes it's us. And I was one of the women that I interviewed for this book was Shirley Tilghman, who's the president of Princeton and a phenomenal leader and a phenomenal person and a scientist. And she told me a story about two freshmen that came to Princeton. And one was a young man, one was a young woman, and they had both won the very prestigious Westinghouse Science Prize. And the Daily Princetonian, the campus paper, went to interview them and talked to both the young man and the young woman. And the young man said, "Oh, my science project was fantastic. I knew I deserved to win, and mine was so great." And then they talked to the young woman, and she said, "Well, my project, it wasn't that good, and I was so surprised when they picked me." And I thought, I hear the same thing all the time. It starts young. And I think we hear it all throughout the business world. I think we undervalue our own accomplishments. So I think women need to start taking more credit. We don't negotiate for salaries. One of the reasons we're underpaid, it's not the only reason, but one of the reasons we're underpaid is we don't ask. Carnegie Mellon did a study with graduate students. They looked at one class of graduate students. The men were 7 times more likely to negotiate their first salary out of school. And they ended up making something like $5,000 or $6,000 more dollars in that first job on average. Well, $5,000 or $6,000 in the first job turns into $500,000 or whatever, you know, $100,000 by the time people are reached retirement age. I mean, the differences over the course of a lifetime are dramatic. And so part of the reason is women don't ask. I think we also don't raise our hands enough. I see it in politics all the time. You know, you'll have somebody recruiting candidates to run for the House of Representatives, and they'll say, "Here's the 5 things it takes to be a good candidate." And a man will go, "I got 2, I'm good to go." And a woman will go, "I've got 4, I'm pretty good on number 5, so if I wait 5 years, I think I'll be there. So can you come back?" And I think, you know, you see that over and over. Women don't raise their hands for more money, they don't raise their hands for promotion, they don't raise their hands to, you know, to toot their own horns. And we don't like to brag. I mean, you know, women are really, I think, in many ways want to share credit, and I think that's great, but we also have to find a way to take credit for what we do, because it's important and it's valuable, and we have to value it if we expect anybody else to value it. So I think there's internal and external obstacles. Finally, when I was writing this book, and I would tell people I was writing a book called Why Women Should Rule the World, so many people said to me, "Well, what about Margaret Thatcher?" And I'd say, "Well, what about her? Well, she ran, you know, she was a woman, but she governed like a man." And I say, you know what, in many ways, that's true. I mean, she was a very tough leader. You know, she's known for things like the War in the Falklands and breaking some unions and hanging out with Ronald Reagan. And but she was considered very successful, which I think was good for women. But I also think it's kind of ridiculous for us to expect one woman to go into a government, in a culture, in a world, you know, created by men and run by men, and expect her to change the whole thing overnight. And then to sort of say, well, that, you know, she didn't do it, so therefore she failed at that, or women don't really want to rule like that. I think the point is, it's not just one woman. It takes a lot of women. My argument is not for one woman at the top of any organization, although the more the merrier, but that's exactly the point, the more the merrier. The more women there are, the more I think we begin to change the culture, and the more women are free to act like women. And both men and women then can pick and choose from the qualities that they want and the ways they want to lead and the problems they want to tackle. So I think when we get to critical mass, where there's enough women in the room that everybody stops counting, that's when things will really begin to change. But I think we have to, you know, in order to get there, we got to knock down some of the external obstacles. We got to find ways to better manage work and family, and we have to begin to address some of these internal obstacles to get there. And I'll leave you with one thought, and then we'll get to the questions and answers. I do think the world would be more peaceful. And sometimes people look at me like I, you know, have eight heads when I say that. But I do think so. And it's partly because I think women are less violent. I think, you know, if you look at crime statistics in the world, I think that's just, I mean, there's evolutionary reasons, in my opinion, why that's true. And, you know, we're not as strong, and so we're not as likely to go pick a fight because we're more likely to get creamed. I mean, we're not dumb. But I also think that part of it is that women bring sometimes different solutions. And one of the stories I came across in doing research for this book was a woman named Frances Kaiser, who's the sheriff in Kerr County, Texas. And she told a story about one day she was driving around listening to a radio, and a call came over the radio. A man she knew was holed up in his house with a gun, threatening to kill himself. His marriage was falling apart, and he had some other problems. But she knew the man, and so she called the officers on the scene, and she said, "Don't do anything. Wait until I get there." So she drove to the scene, and she went into the house with another male officer, and she saw the guy sitting there with the shotgun across his knees. And she walked over to him, and she sat down, and she put her arms around him, and she gave him a hug. And he put the gun down, and he started to cry. And this moment, you know, the situation resolved itself. And eventually, his marriage came back together, and he resolved a lot of his problems, and his life got back on track. And she said, "I think that was in many ways because of my experience as a woman. I knew that he... I knew him, and I knew he didn't want to do it, and I knew that confrontation wasn't going to solve the problem, and I took a chance, but I knew, I just had so much compassion for him in that moment that I think, you know, she created a better outcome to a situation that we know so often ends another way." And so that's one example of one woman's life experience making a huge difference, and I think the more women we bring to the process, the more women, the more we allow women's ways of seeing the world to be as valued as men's, the better outcomes we'll have. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you. Stand up here. Okay. End this yet.
Well, our thanks to Dee Dee Myers, former White House press secretary, political analyst, and author of Why Women Should Run the World. And Ms. Myers, we do have a number of questions, so let's get right to it. There were a number that related to your years as the press secretary, and I got several questions about the biggest challenge that you faced in that job, especially as you look back in hindsight.
Boy, there were so many challenges in that job, and I see my friend Dave Selden, who worked with me at the White House. Hi, Dave. Some of the obstacles have to do with the volume of information that you deal with every day. There's just so much, and it changes every minute. Some of them have to do with the kind of confrontational culture in the briefing room, where everything, you know, it's like being a substitute teacher. You know, they may not like each other when you're not around, but when you're standing in front of them, it's them against you. And so that kind of wears you down. But for me, and information moves so fast in this in the internet age, which was just beginning when I was at the White House, that, you know, there's a relentless quality to the job. And there are a lot of great things about it, too. I mean, you get a front row seat on history, and I got to travel around the world with the president and be part of events in ways I never could have imagined, and it changed my life. But for me, I think there was another level of challenge that was created in many ways, I think, because I was a woman, and it was this. I went to work for Bill Clinton early in the fall of 1991, and I spent, you know, 15 months traveling around the country with him, and I had a great working relationship with him. So when it came, and you alluded to this, Mary, in your introduction, when it came time to start appointing staff, Bill Clinton wanted to find a place for me, but he wasn't sure that I was quite ready to be the White House press secretary. I was 31 years old. I'd never lived or worked in Washington, and I was from California, which, by the way, not a gold star in Washington's way of looking at things. But throughout the campaign, he'd said he wanted to create a government that looked like America, and he was under a lot of pressure from among others, women's groups to appoint women to visible positions. And so he wanted credit for appointing the first woman press secretary. And, you know, and he wanted to find a place for me. So what he did was he gave me the title of White House press secretary, but I had a smaller office, a lower rank, and a lesser salary than my male predecessors. In the first months, George Stephanopoulos was doing the briefing. Later, I did the briefing, but there were still a lot of men with overlapping responsibilities. And so I struggled. I found myself in a predicament that I know too many women end up in, which is you have more responsibility than you have authority. And then you don't have the tools you need to do your job, and then you get blamed when things don't go right. So I found myself, you know, handicapped by that. And I struggled. I fought hard to try to get more authority, to restore. And eventually I was successful at restoring. You know, I was promoted. I got a raise. Eventually, I got moved into the bigger office. But part of the price I had to pay for doing that was I agreed to leave. I mean, I said if you restore this, I will leave by the end of the year. So it was a. I mean, I don't regret drawing a line in the sand and saying I'm not going to continue on like this. But you know, that was. I might have been ready to leave anyway, and I might not have been. I don't know. But anyway, so that was kind of put an additional level of challenge onto what's already a very challenging job. And I think it's something that happens to women. I think I tell the story, one, to sort of, I think, as an example of how this happens to women. But also I think women have to be honest with other women and say, this happened to me. Be aware of it. And if it happens to you, A, it's not your fault, and B, you can survive. Because I think women get discouraged, and they think if they have a failure or if things don't go right, that they can't pick up the pieces and go fight again. Or they feel like the world won't allow them to. And sometimes, by the way, it won't. And I found, for me personally, one of the things that was so compelling about Hillary Clinton's performance over the last week was she got herself up off the mat. She fought her heart out. We saw a fighter in her. And I think even people who aren't for her had to say, wow, you know, I admire her moxie. And when she gave her speech Tuesday night and said, for any of you that have been knocked down and counted out and you got back up, this one's for you, I felt like, yeah, it's for me. Yeah, this one's for me. So anyway, that's my answer.
Thank you. What was it like working for Bill Clinton day to day? And what's your assessment on his presidency with these years of hindsight?
You know, Bill Clinton was in most ways great to work for. The worst thing about working for him was, like, he's the Energizer Bunny. The guy never quit. And during the campaign, he would sleep 4 hours a night. And when he got to the White House, he said, boy, the job's so stressful. I find that not a lot of nights I need six. And I was like, oh, my God. You know, he worked from – he wasn't a real early starter. He didn't usually wander into the Oval Office till about 9 when he could, unless he had an event or something. But, at, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning, he was still on the phone, you know, probably calling you guys from – you know, he was trying to find somebody who was still awake that he could talk to. So that was one of the challenges. You know, there was also that his energy was sometimes also produced a certain chaos. You know, he really liked to be in the middle of a swirling process. He liked to continue to debate issues. He liked to bring as many, he really did like a lot of points of view and as much information and data as he could get. But sometimes that meant the things you thought were solved, answers you thought had been arrived at, weren't really arrived. You know, it was all open for let's renegotiate that one. So that made it tough. There was also some of the personal qualities, you know, the things like Whitewater, and obviously I wasn't there for Monica, thank God. But I did do Jennifer Flowers and the draft and things like that. And so those personal issues were very difficult at times, and very difficult to ask about and very difficult to get to the bottom of, because, you know, it was uncomfortable for any staffer to ask the boss about, you know, personal finances or personal life in any way. So, but on balance, I think he was a very good president. I think, you know, again, some of the mistakes have colored the way a lot of people see him, particularly in the short term. I think over the long term, some of that probably fades. Maybe not, but I think it probably will. And I think, look, he presided over a time of peace and prosperity, a growing economy, and he made some tough choices. I remember in the summer of 1993, his first year in office, he presented a budget that had $500 billion in tax cuts, tax increases, and $500 billion in spending cuts. But the markets responded very favorably to that, and I think it was instrumental in helping to create a period of prosperity that ensued. So I think he made a lot of tough choices. I think the country was better off for his 8 years in office. I think he'll be looked back on as a very good president. And I'm proud and grateful to have worked for him.
Thank you. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Dee Dee Myers, former White House press secretary, political analyst, and the author of Why Women Should Run the World.
Well, I know this is going to be very shocking, but I did receive a lot of questions about the campaign, so I'd like to turn to that.
I'm so surprised.
I know, so surprising. A number of questions related to how dirty do you think the Democratic campaign is going to get, and will that hurt the Democrats in the general election?
That's funny. I've been hearing that a lot in the last few days from Democratic voters and maybe some Republicans. Democrats worried and Republicans gleeful. I think this campaign has been really inspiring up to this point. I think it's been really exciting. I think we've had a number of good candidates, and I think it's been mostly about the issues. It's been much more on the high road. You know, there have been some moments where some things happened that, you know, weren't pretty, but for the most part, I think it's been great. I don't know what's going to—I mean, the last week was, you know, certainly things got tough, and the press got tougher on Senator Obama. I think Senator Clinton got tougher on Senator Obama, and he's now trying to figure out how to sort of hit back. So we're getting into the, you know, the final laps of this, and I do think that will result in a slightly more aggressive, in some ways negative, comparative kind of campaign. And we'll see. I think both candidates are much better candidates than they were 3 months ago or 5 months ago or 8 months ago. And I think continuing to campaign and to make their case and to defend themselves is in many ways a very good thing, even though it's sometimes uncomfortable, because there's nothing that a Democrat is going to say about another Democrat that the Republicans haven't already thought of. Now, sometimes they use the fact that a Democrat said it. That does kind of sometimes add an edge to it in a general election. This is not a criticism coming from John McCain, but it's one coming from Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. But on balance, I think the candidates have to learn to defend themselves against these charges because they are going to come. So I'm still hopeful. I mean, there are some risks in this place we find ourselves. And the risks are part have to do with tone and part have to do with process, right? Because we don't really know where it's going to go from here. And since it seems very difficult for either candidate to get 2,025 delegates that they would need to lock this thing up unchallenged, there's likely going to be some other way we resolve it. The big, you know, in the news today all day has been a conversation about what to do about Michigan and Florida. The DNC disallowed the results. Howard Dean is standing by disallowing the results of these earlier primaries. They broke the rules, you know. But now they're talking about should we encourage a do-over? Should we push those states to reschedule a primary where both candidates can go, be on the ballot and campaign? I personally think that's the best solution. I don't know whether we'll get there, but I think that does a lot of things. First of all, I think it says to the states, you didn't play by the rules, so you got to go back and do it again. Second of all, I think it makes sure that every vote gets counted. If you're a voter in Florida or Michigan, and we Democrats go to the convention without your vote, you're going to feel I would feel disenfranchised. Let's figure out a way to make everybody's vote count. And finally, maybe there's enough votes, delegates in those, if we add those states, to make sure that one of the candidates is substantially ahead by the time the last primary has happened. That would be the best outcome of all would be that we get to the end of this process and one candidate just has a clear lead. More delegates, more total votes, you know, more states, whatever, more delegates being the most, more pledged delegates. And I think if that happens, the superdelegates will all, you know, not all of them, but a majority will break in support of the leading candidate and put that candidate over the top. That would be a great result. That would be a great result where, you know, we took our primary, we took it to the whole country, we asked every voter to weigh in, everybody had to have a voice, and we picked the best, strongest candidate. And then on to the convention and the general election. So I'm optimistic. I do see some potential obstacles and some downsides, but I'm optimistic.
I have a question here asking you to comment on Mrs. Clinton's claim of having experience and more of it than Senator Obama. How do you feel about that?
I think it's indisputable. I think she's had more. We can have an argument about what kind of. You know, what's the most important thing, experience or judgment or what kind of experience? But in terms of government experience, I don't think there's any question about it. Or public service. She's older than he is. She has served in the Senate much longer than he has. I mean, she's no Ted Kennedy, but, you know, she's been there. People want to say the White House doesn't count because she was only the first lady. I think she wasn't the president, and certainly I don't think she's claiming that she was the president, but I think having been there myself, maybe I'm biased, but I think traveling around the world, understanding what the scrutiny is like, meeting with world leaders, seeing how the world looks at us, understanding the reach and the limitations of the United States' power, I think those are all indisputably you know, things that make her, give her a certain perspective and give her qualifications to be president. Are those dispositive? No. But why do we have to say they don't count at all? Because she was just the wife? I mean, why does being married to a guy who was president disqualify? I mean, I hear people say, well, she wouldn't be there if she wasn't Bill Clinton's wife. Oh, so should we disqualify her because her husband happened to be president? What was she supposed to do? You know, go marry somebody else? And, I mean, somebody might argue that, but
yeah,
not because it was in favor of her political campaign. But anyway, so I think her experience is very relevant, and I think it has to be taken in its aggregate. I think she probably needs a better answer on the 3 a.m. question, which is, you know, when did you ever answer the ringing phone? She needs a better answer on that, but I think let's give her credit for her experience, and let's give Senator Obama credit for his experience, and let's let them argue about judgment, because I do think judgment and character are incredibly important to being president. Those are the more intangible qualities, but I think her experience is admirable.
You know, there have been some rather dramatic momentum shifts in this election. Probably, perhaps there may be more to come. What factors, or could you comment on the factors that you think are causing this swing? And if you could put your hat on as a political advisor, what advice would you give first to the Clinton campaign and then to the Obama campaign as to what they should do next?
Yeah, if I had the answers to that last part, I'd be worth a lot of money. The momentum shifts have been fascinating. You know, I think a number of things have gone into them. Most interestingly to me is that it seems like every time a candidate has had his or more often her back against the wall at the brink of elimination, the voters have said, nope, not yet, not going to be over. We want it to go on. We're enjoying this. Or, you know, or we want to see more. And that's part of what happened on Tuesday night. I think voters said, you know what, this, like, we're not ready to, we still have questions, and we still want answers to those questions, so let's let the process go on. I think a couple other things contributed to the most recent momentum shift. One was, I think it's ironic, but I think one of the most significant things that have happened in the last 2 weeks is the Saturday Night Live skit where the press about the press being totally in the tank for Senator Obama. You know, are you comfortable, Senator? I mean, that was the hardest question he got in the mock debate. And I think the press went, nuh-uh, we're not unfair to Senator Obama. We could be really tough on Senator Obama. And so the next week happened to, to Senators Obama's bad fortune happened to coincide with the kind of, you know, a couple of stories coming to the fore. One was about, you know, the Rezko, Tony Rezko went to trial in Chicago on federal criminal charges. And the other was this weird memo that materialized from the Canadian consulate in Chicago where one of Obama's senior advisors had said, oh, yeah, don't pay any attention to his rhetoric on NAFTA. That's not really what he means. And that's a particularly, even though that's a weird story, it's a particularly damaging, it's more damaging in some ways to Senator Obama because he talks about being a different kind of politician, not the kind of politician who says one thing in private and another thing in public. So anyway, the press is sort of jumping on these things. And then, of course, there was the ringing phone ad, which only played in Texas but got a lot of attention in the free media and I think maybe raised some questions about, and Senator McCain piled on with that, by the way, raising some questions about whether Senator Obama was ready to be commander-in-chief. And I think, look, Senator Obama will be better off if he answers those questions in the primary and gets into the general election having really good answers for it. But anyway, I think all those things came together. And finally, it was that quality that I talked about earlier from that that Hillary Clinton showed us, which will morph into the next part of the question, where she got knocked down, she got back up on her feet, she wasn't going to give up. She said, I'm in this until Ohio and Texas, and by God, she fought every day. And I think people saw there's no narrative in American life more compelling to us as a culture than the person who's at the top gets knocked down, picks themselves up by their bootstraps, and fights their way back up. There is no more compelling narrative, except maybe Star Wars. that's when you didn't know your father was your father, and you got to kill your father. But she showed that, and I think that is a clue as to how she should go forward. She should marry experience, and I'm fighting for you, because she's never going to be credible as the soft, I want to hug you candidate. But she is credible as the, I really care about you, and I'm going to fight for you. And when times are hard, I'm going to fight for you. When times are good, I'm going to fight for you. It's not about me. It's about fighting for you. And I think she showed that. And I think it's credible, and I think she's comfortable with it. So, and you know what else I think? I think She has been in recent months better than her campaign. And I was looking at her and thought, okay, so you're doing the negative stuff. You're doing the positive stuff. You're figuring out the strategy. Are you changing the sheets in your hotel room at night? Yeah. I mean, what aren't you doing right now? I felt like she was carrying the whole thing. But anyway, so that's what I would argue for her. For Senator Obama, I think he needs to find a way to contrast himself to Senator Clinton more clearly, because I think he's at a point where he has to do more than just talk about his vision in broad terms. He needs to talk about it more specifically. I think he needs to shore up his credentials on foreign policy. And he has the difficult hurdle for him is how can he draw contrast with Senator Clinton without disillusioning or disappointing his supporters, because his case as a different kind of politician limits his ability to do that. The minute he starts, I mean, today he's talking about Senator Clinton's she should release her tax returns. You know, fair point. It's one that the press has certainly been making, and she said she'd do it, so, you know, she ought to maybe just get on with it. But can he do that without sounding like just another politician? And again, that's something he'll have to do in a general election, too, so you may as well get some practice in now. Anyway, they both have big challenges ahead of them, but I think in 3 months from now, if it doesn't get too nasty, they'll both be better candidates than they were today.
Do you think it's possible that we could see a combination ticket and of with Obama on top or Clinton on top? If you think it's possible, is it possible that either could be on top, or what's your assessment of that situation?
I think it's possible that if Senator Clinton wins, she would ask Senator Obama to serve as her running mate. I don't know that it'll happen. I think it's possible. He has created not just a campaign but a movement, and he's brought a lot of people into the process who are really inspired by his message and who are very invested in his candidacy, and to keep those people invested and also to acknowledge the wonder of what he's done, and I mean that with all sincerity. Putting him on the ticket might make sense. I think if it was reversed, I'm not sure Senator Clinton would be interested. That just doesn't seem as likely to me. I think that's unlikely. And I don't know who Senator Obama would pick, but probably not Senator Clinton.
Do you think that there's any possibility that Ralph Nader's campaign could act as a spoiler in this election?
No. I don't. I hope that's not just hope talking instead of analysis. But, he won, it was 3.7% of the vote in 2000, and enough votes in Florida to, I think, hand George Bush the election after saying it didn't make any difference who was elected. Okay, if you still believe that, I have a bridge in Brooklyn I'd like to sell you. I think the public kind of showed us what they think of him, because he went from 3.7% of the vote to less than 0.5% of the vote in 2004, and I think he's even less credible now, in spite of the mighty presence of a San Francisco supervisor on the ticket. I don't think he'll. But you never know. I mean, it doesn't take very many votes in a really close election to swing one state that might swing the Electoral College. But I don't think he will.
There have been some conservative commentators that have been urging conservatives to vote for Hillary, thinking that she would be the weaker candidate against McCain. I think the latest polls show that either Hillary or Obama would prevail over McCain, although Obama is at 6%, I think, and Hillary at 3%. A lot of water between now and the election, but right. What would be your assessment of the viability of either Obama or Clinton against McCain?
I think the issue kind of set up favors Democrats. The economy is the most the issue that seems most on Americans' minds right now. I think if you look at the generic polls, by big numbers, voters trust Democrats to handle the economy. In fact, by not always big numbers, but almost every issue with the exception of terrorism, in the generic ballots, voters trust Democrats to handle it more than they do Republicans. But generic ballots don't necessarily transfer to the real world. I think the Democrats have a lot of wind at their back, but it always comes down to a binary question. So it's always going to be to one candidate against another candidate. I think Senator McCain has a lot of strengths. I think he also has some weaknesses. Obviously, he has military experience, and people really value and honor his service and his sacrifice on behalf of this country, as we all should and do. But he said himself in a debate he doesn't know much about the economy. It's not his strong suit. He doesn't really have a plan to do things to deal with issues like health care. The public doesn't particularly seem supportive of his idea, his plan to, with regard to the war in Iraq to stay 100 years if necessary. I think people think we could probably wrap it up a little more quickly. And so I think all those things favor. Now, he's pretty good on, you know, he's much more forward-leaning on issues like immigration and the environment, but there's still plenty of room for debate, and I think he'll be, Senator McCain will be under a lot of pressure from conservatives to talk more about security than about, on issues like immigration. So I think the issue matrix favors Democrats. I think Senator McCain has a lot of weaknesses. Plus, he's going to be harpooned to George Bush, and I hope Democrats do this effectively, like Ahab to Moby Dick. You know, he's going to be dragging around the great white whale called the Bush administration. I'd rather be playing our hand than theirs, but we need to give them a candidate, and we have two strong candidates, but they each come with weaknesses. You know, Senator Obama is somewhat untested so far, and we all know Senator Clinton brings, she's had a past, she had a life before this campaign, it comes with her. I think we saw in South Carolina when President Clinton became the issue that people aren't sure they want to go back to that. President Clinton has certainly been an exemplary former president in my view, but I think when he became an angry husband, you know, taking on the world in behalf of his wife, it didn't work out so good. He's gone back to being a former president advocating on behalf of his wife rather than a husband defending her, but I do think it's been interesting that she does better when he recedes a little bit. We didn't see him on Tuesday night. And I don't think that was an accident. So it's complicated. I think both candidates bring some weaknesses up. I think either one could beat John McCain, but, you know, it's not easy, and I don't think we Democrats should underestimate the challenge that lies ahead. For those of you who aren't Republicans, I mean, who are Republicans, I hope you lose. I love San Francisco.
It looks like we're going to go into the end of the primary season with a split in the delegates, with neither candidate able to win an outright majority of delegates. And already you hear arguments about how the superdelegates ought to count and ought to vote. What's your sense of how this process is going to work out? And if you have a prediction to make, who do you think is going to come out as the nominee?
Every prediction I've made is wrong. So, you know, I honestly don't know. I think I think it's still more likely. I'm an optimist. I think it's still more likely that we'll get to the end of this process and somebody will have the most pledged delegates and probably the most votes. And I think that person should be the nominee. You know, Senator Obama has an advantage on that front right now. If Senator Clinton does really well in Pennsylvania and we have do-overs in Florida and Michigan and she does well in North Carolina and West Virginia, whatever, you can make a scenario where she catches up. If that happens and she has the most delegates, then she should be the nominee. The most delegates, the most votes, you know. But it'll get really tricky if one has more votes and one has more delegates. Or if you start, you know, and then you know what will happen. They'll start parsing the states, and Senator Clinton will say something like, well, I won more votes from Democrats. You know, he won independents and Republicans, but I won more Democrats. Or, you know what I mean? It could get tricky. Or he has more delegates, but what about Puerto Rico? Does that count the same? You know what I mean? Does that count the same as? So I hope that it's clear, and I'm hopeful that it will be. These things generally have a way of working out. On the other hand, as the questioner asked before, the momentum keeps, you know, it's like a ping pong match with one side seeming to be inevitable only to be followed by a twist where they finally suddenly find themselves on the defensive. So I hope that it gets to that point. And if it's virtually tied and one person only has a tiny advantage in pledged delegates or somebody has and the other candidate has, say, an advantage in raw vote, then I think the superdelegates are going to decide it. I don't think that's the best outcome, but that's the only option left if we get to that point. So for the meantime, I think the superdelegates should mostly stay out of it. I think some of them, you know, if you're the senator from North Carolina or something, you want to take a position in this race in advance of your primary, I think that's okay. But I think most of the superdelegates should just stay on the sidelines, let the process play out, let the voters have their say, and then see what their options are. And I hope that's what they do.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Dede Meyers, former White House press secretary, political analyst, and author of Why Women Should Run the World. I also received a number of questions that seem to be stimulated by the research that you did in your book. One question came up several times, what do you think the impact on the cultural bias and the psyches of women in this country would be from having a woman president
a woman in the most powerful position in the world.
Right. I think he would be substantial, and not just for women and girls in the United States, but around the world, because the President of the United States is still the most powerful person in the world. And I've been asked a lot lately, well, what do you think, I mean, how would she do if she had to go into countries where they don't respect women and they had to deal with her? Wouldn't she be at a disadvantage? I said, you know what? When you fly into a country on Air Force One as the commander-in-chief of the world's biggest military with this whole contingent behind you and all of the economic and military power that is the United States, they'll pay attention. It's going to be all right, you know? So I don't worry about that at all. But I do think the message that it would send to women around the world that women can rise to this position, that they can succeed in it, that they can represent the United States and hopefully be a force for good in the world would be fantastic. But again, you know, my argument isn't, and I think it would be great, and, you know, if Hillary Clinton were president, I think, you know, it would be extraordinary. But if she's not, I think she will have moved the ball forward for women. No woman has ever even won a primary in a presidential contest in this country. Hillary's the 21st woman to try. She's the first to even reach that milestone. I think, in fact, that was, by the way, completely overlooked in the historic nature sometimes of Senator Obama's campaign. But and I also think that she's really made the case in an indisputable way that a woman can be a credible candidate for president. She's been not just a good candidate, but a really good candidate. Even, you know, she just happens to be running against a phenomenon called Barack Obama. And if he wins, you know, you've got to just give him credit for running a really smart and compelling race. So, you know, in many years, she would have just, you know, kicked everyone's booty all across America, but not this year. So, anyway, so I think she moves the ball forward. I think she makes it easier for the next woman. As you look around, the training ground for women tends to be the United States Senate or governor's houses, you know, state houses. And there aren't enough women in those positions. There are some, and people like Kathleen Sebelius, the governor of Kansas, who I think is phenomenal. She's a great example of a woman who raised her hand, took some chances, ran for office, and has been a successful Democrat in a red state. And so I look at women like, and I think if Senator Obama is the nominee, that he might, I think she'll be on the short list. I mean, she may not be the vice president, but she'll be on the short list because she's great.
You alluded earlier to the press treatment of Hillary and Obama and the differences. How significant do you think those differences really are? You're a fairly experienced observer. And why do you think it's happening, if you do? And what would be the best way to get it to change?
I do think there has been a disparity in treatment between the two campaigns. I think that's changing. I mean, at least it was last week. I know you think it'll just go right back. They had a you're shaking your head. So yeah, they have been tough, no question about it. I don't think the only reason is gender. I think that it's also, you know, the news is what's new, and the thing that's new in this campaign is Barack Obama, and you know the story is compelling. Can he do it? And so I think part of it comes from they're just tired of the whole Clinton thing, and they're ready for a new story. That's not a very good excuse for the coverage. It's just one of the reasons I think it's happened. And then I do think there has been some. I just think you can say things about a woman, for example, without any penalty. For example, when Senator McCain was at a rally last fall, and a woman stood up. It was a town hall, and a woman stood up and said, "How do we beat the bitch?" And you know what Senator McCain's response was? "That's a good question." You know, not like, excuse me, but that's really an inappropriate way to talk about a United States senator and a candidate in this, you know, an American, or any woman, by the way. He said, "That's a good question." When a radio talk show host at one of his rallies was sort of talking about Senator Obama in inappropriate ways, McCain rightly disavowed the guy. That's what he should have done. You know, he should have said something to the woman. So I think that's an example of how there's not much penalty for saying things about women, for endorsing certain attitudes about women. We've heard all the words used in reference to Senator Clinton. She's too shrill. She's hectoring. You know, she bothered. I don't like her. And I think all that's kind of crept into the coverage. Now, some of that's particular to her personality. I don't think we can attribute every problem she's had by any stretch of the imagination to gender. But I do think those attitudes that if a woman is too tough or she does this, or we can say these things about her, I just think it creates an obstacle for women that men don't face.
What advice would you have for young women who are interested in getting into politics, and what do they have to do differently to increase the trajectory of their political careers?
Right. I think politics is you know, there could be more women, there should be more women, and there will be more women if young women go get it. I think I've really loved my time in electoral politics, and I think it's not only an interesting place to work, I think it's important to, you know, I think it invests people in the process and makes them, you know, better and informed and, you know, more engaged citizens in a lot of ways. So I totally encourage young people to get involved in politics. I think generally, and in politics too, I think two things that women need to do, young women in particular. One is just go raise their hands and say, you know, I want in, and go try to find, you know, go work on a campaign, go make yourself useful, you know, believe in your talents and just go do it. So, you know, raise your hand and take a chance and go do it. And the other thing is, I think women, it would be great for women to find more mentors. When I was at the White House, you know, again, I was new to Washington, I was young, and I didn't get help with things that I could have gotten help with. Everything from my appearance, which sometimes didn't quite reach the market, could have, to just the tribal rituals of Washington, and, you know, how this place worked. And as I look back, there were so many women that would have been willing to help me, and I never asked because I didn't know. I just hadn't figured it out yet. And I was 31; I wasn't 25, or 22. But I think so. Even at 31, I didn't know that all these women there would help me, and they would have, and men too. I mean, I had a lot of men who helped me. So I think young women need to raise their hands for a job, and they need to ask for help, because I think women and men, but women in particular, need to help other women, and to help them, you know, to navigate the sometimes tricky shoals of being a woman who's trying to make it in sometimes male-dominated endeavors. And the more young women do that, I think the more success they'll have. But because, for example, it's hard to recruit women to run for office, but when women run for office, they're everybody as likely as men statistically to be elected. They're just half as likely to run. And I think we need to remember that we're everybody as likely to succeed, but we're probably half as likely sometimes to take some of the chances that we need to get there.
You know, you've mentioned the names of a couple of other rising women politicians. But I did get a question about if Hillary fails, are there other women who you think in the next few years could be at the forefront of these political parties, or are we going to be waiting a long time?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, if you ask me, are there any other men, I have trouble answering that question, too. I mean, quite honestly, I think it's not until, I mean, it's not that obvious sometimes. I mean, I suppose if you'd asked me this 4 years ago, I would have said I think eventually Barack Obama might make an interesting presidential candidate. I certainly didn't think he would do it in 2007, 2008. I think there are people like Kathleen Sebelius out there. Janet Napolitano is the governor of Arizona, who's an interesting figure. And there are other women around the country. There's, you know, some in the United States Senate. But I think it's hard to – so I haven't really thought enough about the question, but I certainly don't think – I don't have a list of men either. I think the list of women is short. It's too short. We need to make it longer. But I think that Hillary Clinton will have helped make it possible and easier for the next woman to take it on.
I just got an interesting question. I've done this myself, and I know you have also, Dee Dee, in your answers, that we've talked about Hillary Clinton as Hillary, and we've referred
right.
to McCain and Obama by their last names.
Right.
Is that sexist, or is that why do you think that happens?
Well, you know, it's something I actually write about in my book, because I do often refer to her as Hillary, and I realize that one of the reasons is because she refers to herself as Hillary. You know, her campaign posters don't say Clinton. Partly it's because there's another Clinton out there who we all are familiar with. And it's partly because people refer to her as Hillary, which I do think Hillary is less authoritative than Senator McCain or Governor Giuliani or, you know, whatever. I mean, Mayor, God forbid, Mayor Giuliani, Governor Huckabee, whatever. You know, I do think we tend to refer to men by their titles and women by their first names. I mean, it happened to me. I was always Dee Dee, and when, you know, Stephanopoulos was Stephanopoulos, or, you know what I mean? It was always, but so I do think it's less authoritative. But in Hillary's case, I think it's partly what she's chosen to do. And I've wondered at times, it's more complicated for her because her husband was Clinton before she was Clinton. I do think there is a vestige of you know, disparate treatment in the first name thing, generally.
We're getting down to the wire, so I just have a few more questions that I can ask today, and I want to thank the audience very much for the great questions. In all your years of experience in a male world and in the world of politics, and as a first in the role that you had at the White House press office. What tips would you have for young women or women of all ages in dealing with that kind of an environment and making sure that they themselves are successful?
I think that women have to, again, make sure they get credit for their accomplishments. I have been asking women this particular question as I've traveled around for the last couple of years, and I've almost found no one that hasn't had this experience that's been in a male-oriented, male-dominated business world. Have you ever been in a meeting, and you're the only woman, or there's maybe one other meeting, and the conversation is proceeding, and you say something, and everyone ignores you, and like 3 minutes later, a man says substantially the same thing, and everyone goes, great idea. What do you do about that? And I can't, I mean, is there any woman that's been in this kind of situation, that this, to whom this has never happened? Right, right. No one, it's happened to all of us. I came across a woman who gave an example of how she thinks she should handle it. She said, what you do is you go, Bill, I'm so glad you liked my idea, and I really like the way you restated it. And I think if we're all in agreement, we should move forward with my idea, which was X. You know, that way you're giving the man credit. You're not confrontational, saying, hey, that was my idea. But you're making the point that, hey, that was my idea. And I think that's pretty good advice. We have to find ways to stand up for ourselves that are not confrontational, because we know that confrontation doesn't work for us. Maybe it's not something we're comfortable with, but we know it's not that well received. But that make the point, that take the credit, that move us forward. So I think that's an important thing. And I think, you know, we have to find ways to negotiate for our salaries and to make sure that our ideas are heard. It's not easy, and I think women have to share their successes with other women, the ways, oh, here's how I did it, and here's what worked for me. Maybe that would work for you. And I think, again, the more women that we have, the more these problems will recede a little bit. So part of the answer is just more. More is more when it comes to women in the workplace and across public life.
And the last question, I think it's an indication of how much the audience has enjoyed your presentation. Would you consider running for office? And if so, which one?
There are, I'll tell you the most off-putting, there are a number of things that make me say, not now, but I would never say never. One of them is the demands of fundraising. That really puts me off. And I think it probably is one of the deterrents for a lot of women, that the relentless demand. I think a lot of men, too, are put off by the relentless demands to raise money. And one of the problems for me is I'm from California, I'm from Southern California, but I live in Washington. You know, there's nothing to run for in Washington. There's a lot to run from. So if I was going to run for the House, say, from where I grew up, besides the fact that it's a totally Republican seat, then you're traveling back and forth across the country 3,000 miles. God bless Dianne Feinstein, who does it on behalf of all of us Californians regularly. But with two young kids, it's probably not in my cards for right now. But, you know, I never say never, because I so admire the people who do it. I think it's important. I so admire the women who do it, who've broken paths for the rest of us. You know, not this cycle, but maybe someday. So that's my answer. But thank you all so much for being here. I appreciate you listening to me.
So our thanks to Dee Dee Myers, former White House press secretary, political analyst, and author of Why Women Should Run the World. We thank our audiences here on the radio, and we are adjourned.